So if you are devoted to or you venerate something that is problematic, it'll come out in your ethics. That's his basic point. Whatever you venerate, whatever you're devoted to, that comes out in your ethics. And so Aristides basically looks at the four types of people in the world, in his sort of categorization of peoples of the world, the four types of people in the world, and he says, okay, what you venerate is what you will imitate. So the way that we can tell whether or not you're venerating the right things is by your ethics, is by the life you live. The life you live is going to reveal the truthfulness of whatever it is you venerate.
Welcome to the Apologetics Podcast. I'm Garrick Bailey. In each episode of this serious but lighthearted podcast, Timothy Paul Jones and I explore evidences for the truth of Christianity. And along the way, we even talk about movies, music, and culture.
If you're interested in supporting this podcast and receiving shirts, mugs, and more, go to patreon.com/threechordsandthetruth. That's chords with an H, the kind you play, not the kind you plug.
Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to the Apologetics Podcast, where we defend the faith, do justice, and dig for truth in rock and roll.
And in this, there's three key points that Aristides makes. And I think each one of these is so relevant for us today. The first point that Aristides makes is that Christians practiced radical civic good without bowing to the civic gods. And the second one he makes is that in Christianity, there's a coherence between profession and practice. And the third one of those is that Christianity calls for a public practice of the truth.
Does he use the wording, or does this come a little bit later, but it's related? We're essentially part of the argument is we, Christian Romans, are better Romans. We're better citizens than the rest of you, essentially.
Yeah, and Aristides doesn't say it quite that way, such as there are some who do in his same time period. So this doesn't come later. It's in the Christian around this time. He just doesn't say that. So you do see that, let's say, in Epistle to Diognetus. You see that. You see it to some degree in Athenagoras, who's around the same time. So this is part of what's going on. In other words, Aristides isn't the only Christian making this argument, basically. There are others who are making the same argument, but making this in a different way.
These guys are getting together at the bar late at night. Well, actually, they're Christians, so maybe the coffee house early in the morning, having their coffee and their avocado toast, and they're having the discussion, and a couple of them just get a little bit more testy.
In this, what we do see is the degree to which they are communicating with each other. And yet there's a lot of it is just part of their enculturation as Christians, because you see the same things showing up in very different places. It's like, how does Aristides of Athens and somewhere, you know, wherever, we don't know for sure where Epistle to Diognetus comes from or was going to, but it doesn't seem to be the same context as Athenagoras. How on earth do these people say the same thing? And Aristides says things that are similar. Well, it's part of the culture of Christianity for them. That's really, there's a shared culture.
There was an early apologist Slack channel that they were on, you know, or a message board, maybe Facebook group. That's probably how it happened.
Almost certainly, yes. Almost. Maybe they had MySpace back then. Zanga.
Yes, probably Zanga back then. That's where it started. I love that point. So point number one, Christians practice radical civic good without bowing to the civic gods. And then you mentioned the second point, in Christianity, there's a coherence between profession and practice. Those two are very related. They're like, feels like there's a lot of overlap. I feel like if you're wording it today, it would be Christians practice radical civic good without bowing to the civic gods, because here's our profession that results in, that demands this particular practice, which doesn't allow us, that requires us to be in the world, to be salt, to be a light in the darkness. And so we must be here. Christ calls us to, but there's a certain way of being that doesn't allow us to bow down to your gods.
And I think in my mind, these two are stating the same thing, one negatively and one positively. To say that we have this profession that prevents us practicing certain things, that's kind of the negative declaration. And then the positive declaration is this notion of we are actually doing more civic good than the world around us does. And these questions that they're wrestling with, of course, they're not the same as we are wrestling with. Nobody is demanding that we go and engage in a sacrifice to a particular god or something like that. But I think it's important for us to recognize that there is a civic liturgy that we are increasingly expected to follow. And what I mean by that is a civic liturgy, that there are ceremonies, there are vestments, we might say, which people are expected to wear. What I mean by that is if somebody in a sports situation who is on a professional sports team chooses not to participate in something honoring a pride night, whether by wearing a patch or by participating in a particular portion of this ceremony, we might say, if they do, they are disenfranchised or marginalized in some sense. They are seen as outsiders in some sense and can even be mocked or penalized because they are not participating in the civic liturgy that is demanded. And there's even the things we say. We are expected, perhaps, in certain situations to use particular pronouns that conflict with our faith, things like that. All those things, these are, in some sense, religious in nature. That is to say, they are liturgies of things you say, things you don't say, things you wear, things you don't wear, and you are marginalized from the community as a whole if you don't participate in these things. And so that's what we face today. And that is analogous to, it's not identical to, but it is analogous to what the early Christians were facing when they were marginalized for not bowing down to and sacrificing to the Roman gods in their context.
And this wouldn't have been the case for Aristides and the earliest guys, but within a couple hundred years, a similar problem would be faced, but in the other direction. And so I think of a similar example of a liturgy that if you didn't participate in, that it could get you in some hot water. And so I think about churches, or I think about pastors I know who have gone to churches, and especially I think usually the example seems to be an older church, more kind of a more traditional church, and sometimes calling a somewhat younger guy. I don't mean like in his 20s, but certainly younger than the congregation. And it's one of those churches that has white columns, red carpet, and up on the stage, on the sides of the stage, you have the Christian flag, and right next to the Christian flag, you have the American flag, and there's the traditional Sunday that's closest to July 4th becomes a really big deal and sometimes a production. And I've known of pastors who have gone in and changed that or pushed really hard against that. And there's been a lot of fallout, has received the same type of treatment that you and I are talking kind of that happens in culture now from kind of from the post-Christian side, can even happen within the Christian culture itself, and the way we would say, or as a result of the Christian culture and the American culture, the American kind of political, civil culture becoming too intertwined.
I think so. And as I think about that in terms of church history, I think of Athanasius, because Athanasius, he stood up against Constantine when Constantine was favoring Christianity. And yet when Constantine dabbled into and reached into and interfered with the church in a way that was inappropriate, Athanasius even endured exile to push back against the powers that be. So in other words, this doesn't occur only to our left, it occurs to our right. This is something we have to be careful of, and authentic Christianity, proclaimed in its purity, will critique both the right and the left. And we have to remember that. It's not going to fit comfortably. Here's a better way of putting it. It's not going to fit comfortably in either the right or the left. It will never fit comfortably. It will speak critique and judgment in the sense of speaking God's judgment, God's justice, God's truth. It will speak that both right and left.
I remember sometime in 2020, which wasn't a contentious, divisive year at all, our friend Patrick Schreiner, and I can't remember the context other than the whole world for that whole year. Yeah, I remember something he tweeted. It was something to the effect of, maybe, just maybe, if both the right and the left are mad at you, maybe you're doing something right. It just hit home so well that year, because I feel like a lot of us that were trying to live in the middle, that saying itself has the middle way, has this baggage to it. But those of us who are, trying to live with nuance and trying to balanced way of being in this world that we feel like was kind of the example of Christ, again, that he engaged the world, but didn't embrace it in such a way that he kind of critically, uncritically accepted and adopted and whatnot, right? I read a saying last night that was new to me, or I read a phrase last night that was new to me, that like Christ, we are to be against the world for the world. And I just hadn't, and that phrase I just thought was so beautiful and made so much sense, and I hadn't seen it before. It's like, oh, well, yes. It's easy to be against the world, but if we're against the world in the same way that Christ was, it's actually for the world, for its good.
And I think there's been a secular narrative too that pretends that if we leave Christianity behind, or if we leave religion behind, we would leave behind all of these archaic liturgies and rituals. I think that's been part of kind of an assumption. And so there's almost a denial that there are secular or non-Christian, if we don't want to use the word secular there are non-Christian liturgies that shape people just as much as there are Christian liturgies that shape people. And I think that's really important to see that we can't live without liturgy. These repeated actions that are imbued with sacred significance, we can't live without them. Like, everybody has them. On the right, we see it. We talked about, having to have the American flag in the sanctuary, where there's wonderful places to have an American flag. At a baseball game, I am taking off my hat. I am looking at that flag. I am respecting that flag, because a baseball game is the right place for that type of honor. But in the church sanctuary, that's not the place for that honor. That's not what that is dedicated to. But it also happens, as I said, on the left of things, when we talk about the civic liturgies of pride patches and the civic liturgies of all of these things where we are bowing to a particular cultural god. We will have liturgies whether we have religion proper or not. We will have liturgies no matter what. And I see that even in the first episodes of this current season 3 of The Mandalorian. What's amazing to me in that, what's fascinating to me in The Mandalorian, is the degree to which there are liturgies and people actually are invested in and care about these liturgies. He has to atone for his sin against the order of this order of Mandalore that he is part of. He's got to atone for that by going and dipping in the sacred waters, all of these things like this. The first episode of this season is the apostate. He has to be redeemed. It is so rich with liturgy, and people are invested in this liturgy, and yet we live in a world in which we're leaving that behind. No, you're not. You're hungry for it. Your soul needs liturgy, where there are things you are repeating and that you are imbuing those with sacred significance. That is the way God created us. We just misdirect it.
It's funny, Timothy, at the end of the episode, I think it was towards the end, someone or multiple people saying, "This is the way." And without missing a beat, my eldest child finished, "And the way and the truth," right? And the truth and the life. I mean, right after it, and me knowing what conversation we're having, I chuckled and was like, "Look, she doesn't even know what you and I are talking about." And like, she sees it. She made the connection immediately.
This is the way.
This is the way. This is the way.
We've already touched on the overlap of the first point, the second point, kind of same thing, different statements. But the full point, I want to get into it and pick it apart. And the full point is, as you stated, was Christianity is a coherent commitment. It's a very careful wording you have there that requires consistency between profession and practice. Let me just acknowledge the great Baptist alliteration that either you put in. If this is Aristides' exact wording, then I'm going to go ahead and just call him a Baptist, the first Baptist, because all the C's and the P's that he put in there, it's really perfect. But can we dissect that? Coherent commitment, consistency. We've touched on the profession and practice part, but what is the key thing that Aristides is getting at here that he felt people need to see this, need to understand this about Christianity?
Well, Aristides, I am going to claim him as a Baptist no matter what. Though the alliterations are mine, I'm still claiming Aristides as a Baptist. But here's what we have to understand in the ancient world in which he existed, this Roman, Greco-Roman context, this second century sort of slice of the Roman Empire, is that no one around him, or very few people around him, would have the slightest problem saying, on the one hand, "I don't believe in the gods," and yet on the other hand, going and sacrificing in the temple to the gods, and even believing that sacrificing in the temple to the gods brings, in some sense, a favor upon their social order, and yet at the same time denying the existence of the gods. We hear that, and we think that's a contradiction, to say you don't believe in it and yet you still go and participate in that civic liturgy. We don't see that as something we could do.
If you don't believe, we call you an atheist.
Yes.
Atheist had a different meaning in the ancient
right.
world.
So an atheist was somebody who didn't participate in the practices of those gods. And somebody then, they couldn't envision why you wouldn't, because it's like, you don't have to believe in it. I don't believe in them. I mean, they might say, "I don't believe in them, but I still go to the temple. I still do the sacrifices in the temple." Why not just go ahead and go do the sacrifices, even if you don't actually believe it? That was okay from the Roman perspective.
It's probably helpful for folks to know that one of the earliest accusations of Christians that the early apologists had to clear up was, we were accused of being atheists. But they knew our belief. They knew that we believed in a God, but we were wacky because we only believed in one God. We were called atheists because we did not participate in and acknowledge the Roman pantheon of the civic gods. That's where the charge came from.
And this charge of atheism was one of the most common charges against Christians, which was to say you don't participate in the civic liturgies of the gods. And the Romans just didn't understand that. They're like, just go ahead and do it. You don't have to believe it. Go ahead and do it. I was at University of Michigan in Ann Arbor a few months ago doing research in papyri and looking at some of the papyrus there.
The
there
font?
We go.
The papyri. Oh, not the font.
The papyri. Okay, right. And I ran across something that's really fascinating. And it's from the third century. It was about a century later after this. And it was a document that you had to have signed by somebody who was an official of the state or a governor or whatever that might be. And it had to be signed by them that you had been seen doing a sacrifice of some sort to one of the Roman gods. And this it was called a labellus. It's a type of a labellus. There are actually multiple types of that. But anyway, this was something that was used to prove that you weren't a Christian. This one survives from the middle of the third century to this day. It's in the University of Michigan. And it's there. And it's this proof that I am not a Christian. How do you prove you're not a Christian? The way you prove you're not a Christian is that you were seen sacrificing. Why? Because they knew Christians didn't do that. And this was something that everybody else, whether they believed in the gods or not, they would at least do the sacrifices. And so I emphasize that because of the fact that we, because we are so influenced by the Christian tradition in Western civilization, we can't imagine in some sense doing it even if you don't believe it. That's something that is something we can't get our mind around. But for them in their day, you would have done it. Many of the philosophers didn't believe in the gods. Many of the philosophers didn't. In fact, Augustine points this out. He says, look, one of the reasons Christianity is revealed to be true, according to Augustine and De Vera Religione, is that Christians practice what they profess. And he says the philosophers, they had the right profession in terms of denying the reality of the gods, but they didn't practice what they profess. And that was something that Augustine pointed out in one of his works. And so what Aristides articulates, and he's not alone in this, other Christians in his day too do this as well. This coherence between the profession and the practice of Christians. But then he carries this on through and emphasizes not only the external coherence, but also the internal coherence of Christianity. So he says, basically, our profession is coherent with our practice. And unlike the gods and the liturgies and all of that of the Greeks and the Romans, there is also internal coherence. And so he critiques the Greeks, for example, and he says, look, you made righteous laws, and yet you venerate and imitate unrighteous gods whose actions contradict the very laws you made. So his point is that the Greek religion, in that instance, is internally incoherent. And he points out Christianity is not only externally coherent, our profession and our practice match, but also internally coherent, that there is not a contradiction internally in Christian theology. And this is a huge part of Aristides' argument. He goes through, he re-narrates the story of either the Jews, the Greeks, or the barbarians. He goes through each one of these. He re-narrates their story to show that their stories have internal or external contradictions. And then he says, look, Christianity is internally coherent and externally coherent. It's absolutely a brilliant argument that he makes for this coherence and consistency of Christianity.
Are kind of the current movements is the wrong word, but folks that are out there talking about cultural apologetics or narrative apologetics, do they make explicit connection to Aristides and early apologists as that this being a big kind of part of their way of defending, clarifying Christianity and its beliefs and practices?
Not really, but they should. And once I recover Aristides for everybody, they will.
Retrieving Aristides.
Yes. I mean, it honestly is one of the things I want to do in this is to show people that are doing those type of apologetics. I think they're right to do them, to say, hey, he's giving you an example that is rich and deep and beautiful of showing this internal coherence of Christian faith and external coherence of profession and practice. That's something that Aristides just is giving you. And I think in our context, it's important. And I think Aristides was on this track, though what I'm doing is developing it a little further in saying this, is that one of the things we have to recognize is that there are fragments of truth and beauty and goodness in every profession that is made, every false statement that is made, every false religion, every false practice, there are still some fragments, tiny fragments perhaps, but they are there, of truth and beauty and goodness. But here's the thing, and this is what Aristides provides us with sort of a template for thinking this way. Those fragments of truth and beauty and goodness that are in those false professions that are embedded in even those things that are untrue, that those tiny fragments don't fit there. They fit with Christianity, but they don't fit where they actually are. In other words, the Romans were right that there are gods to be venerated, and they were right to see that a god had to be a prime mover to start the world. There had to be some prime mover and some god who created the world as beautiful as it is. I mean, so in those times, in those things, Aristides is pulling things from pagan philosophers, and they were right to do that. So there's fragments of truth and beauty and goodness in their false professions, and Aristides points those out. But then he points out that those fragments of truth and beauty and goodness that are present in Aristotle, that are present in some of the other philosophers and some of the other religions, those fragments don't fit well within their religions, but they fit within Christianity. So every time there is a fragment of truth or beauty or goodness in something that is false, it doesn't fit there, but it fits in Christianity. And so that becomes a starting point, a sort of foothold for us to say that Christianity is true by showing that part of your religion right there, that's actually right. It's beautiful, or it's true, or it's good. It's there. It's good. He said, but that actually fits better in my faith that I'm professing, this faith grounded in Jesus Christ, than it does in your faith. So maybe if that which you agree is true, because it's there in your religion. Maybe if it fits better in my profession than it does in yours, maybe the profession that I am articulating on the basis of who Jesus is, maybe that's actually the truth. And it is sort of a foothold. And that's what Aristides does. He introduces the whole thing by saying, look, the world is beautiful. The world is orderly. There's a certain type of God that that would require. When he's saying these things, he is drawing from pagan philosophers when he says that. And then he goes on and says, look, of Jews, of Greeks, of barbarians, which one has a God that fits those different categories right there that are true? And he says, even if you actually are agreeing with me about those categories, your religion, as you practice it, doesn't fit with the very categories that we've agreed are true, that the world is beautiful, that it's created by a good God, a God who needs nothing, but all things need him. But there is a religion that it fits perfectly with, and that is what is revealed in Jesus Christ.
And the current people writing in the realm of apologetics or cultural engagement or this space we call worldview analysis, the most compelling men and women are the ones who do these same things when they're talking about what does it look like to be kingdom people in this culture, in this world that is increasingly hostile to God's kingdom. These are the types of things that they say. And these are the people I find compelling. And not only do I find them compelling, but I don't see another way forward in our cultural moment that's better than this. And I don't think that should surprise anyone, because I think this is what the conversation essentially that Peter's having in his letters of what it is going to look like to be Christians in a post-Christian world.
And I see this also in, this isn't something we're just newly rediscovering. It's also in Bovink. I think it's in Bovink, in the early volumes of Reformed Dogmatics. There's a section there where he recognizes, which is not recognized as clearly by some other Dutch Reformed theologians. Kuyper doesn't recognize this with the clarity that Bovink does, for example. But he talks about how the unbeliever actually really does experience and know real truth, beauty, and goodness. And that's important that he's recognizing this. But then he goes on and says that the unbeliever recognizes it only in its appearance, whereas we as Christians can know it in its essence. They only know it in its appearance, but they really know it. And we know it in its essence. That is beautiful. That is the core of what I teach when I teach worldview analysis at Boyce College, is that right there. I just emphasize that. That's something that is actually integral to the entire semester of worldview analysis, is this notion that the non-believer truly does experience truth and beauty and goodness, but they experience it in its appearance, whereas we as Christians can know it because we know the God from whom it comes. We know it in its essence.
It's been really fun over the past couple of years to see your conversion to Christianity. And by that, I mean to Herman Bovink, the greatest theologian since Jesus. You mentioned truth. I don't think you meant to set up the segue so perfectly, but the third point that you mentioned from Aristides. Let's talk about that. And that is that apologetics calls the community, the Christian community, the community of faith, calls the church to the public practice of truth. And again, there's these three points are so intertwined and so much overlap. I mean, you can't help but see just the logical flow of that. Really, I'm picturing Aristides writing this, that it truly is this outpouring of this deep, passionate conviction that's in him, that where he is like, this is contending for the faith. When I think about that phrase, contending for the faith, I think of this Aristides and how his three points, he's saying three different things, but you can just see that it's all coming from this same place, this one logic of what he sees as the biggest challenge for people seeing Christianity for what it is. So let's talk about that third point. Christians must, we are apologetics calls, I would say apologetics calls, because Christ has called his followers to the public practice of truth.
So one of the things I think is important as we look at this is what we started with all the way back at the very beginning is thinking through the fact that the world has changed in such a way that people do not see Christianity as being good for the world. So that notion right there. And so what I want us to wrestle with as we look at this point is the question of, will doing what Aristides says, will doing these things make the world see Christianity, the culture and the world around us, see Christianity as something that's good for the culture or good for the world? And the answer is actually no. I don't actually think that it will cause the world around us to see us as good for the world. I just don't think that's actually going to happen. And clearly in that encouragement is not my spiritual gift. I'm just saying, no, the world's still not going to say, oh, we want to hear you in the public square. That's not what the world is going to do. But, and this is the important point for the apologies, not only of Aristides, but also Justin and Athenagoras, all of those, I don't think they really intended to change the culture's perception of them. I don't think they actually did. And if they were trying to do that, they failed miserably because the worst persecutions of the church were yet to come. I don't think they were trying to do that, nor do I think that should be what we're trying to do. Rather, and this is to this third point, we are calling the church to the public practice of the truth. We are calling the church to do this because here's what I think Aristides and the others, their point really was not to try to convince the world Christianity is good for the world, not to convince their culture that somehow Christians were good for the civic order. I don't think that's what they're trying to do. Here's what they were trying to do. They were trying to form a type of community that outlasts every power on earth that may be arrayed against the people of God. That's actually what they were trying to do. And I think that's what we ought to be doing, is that we are going to form a community that will publicly practice the truth, even if the world thinks our practice is absurd, and worse than absurd, it's harmful for the civic order, even if they perceive us in that way, that we still will publicly practice the truth. And that actually answers a dilemma in Aristides and some other apologists of why do they address their apology to the emperor? Because people may not recognize this. There is no chance the emperor ever read this, and probably the apologist never intended the emperor to read this. They didn't intend the emperor to read this. So why'd they address it to the emperor? Well, by addressing it to the emperor, they actually moved it from a private sphere in the church to a public sphere. They moved what they're doing to the public sphere. In other words, by addressing it to the emperor, they are declaring to the people of God that this faith is to be practiced publicly. They are to publicly practice their faith. And so it in some sense imbued this with a public accountability. To mention the emperor in this said, this is something that you are publicly accountable to live the lifestyle that we have described in these apologies. You are to live it publicly. And I think that's really important for us today, because there are some who would say, okay, just hunker down and draw everything in and let's just wait secularity out. And we don't have that option. Not in the early apologists. It's saying, no, we don't hunker down, pull everything in and cloister ourselves up and just try to batten down the hatches and wait till secularity passes over us. No, we are called to the public proclamation and public practice of what we believe. Not saying, oh, us publicly practicing it is going to make everybody love us. No, we are called to practice it publicly because that's part of the formation of a type of people, a type of people that are going to outlast all of this. Not because we have drawn everything in and gotten in the bunker, but because of the fact it forms a type of publicly accountable people who declare and live their faith even through persecution. They live that and are publicly accountable for living it. That's what we're going for. So let's think about this a little bit more. Even if our defenses don't persuade the world that Christianity is good for the social order, our defenses form a community that persists in holiness, in love, in proclamation of the gospel. And no matter how vast the gap may grow between us and the prevalent culture, this gospel remains, in the words of Paul, the power of God for salvation for everyone who believes. And that kind of brings me back to the young woman that I described all the way back at the beginning, who preferred her own bisexual self-conception over the evidence for the resurrection that she herself admitted was compelling. And sadly, during the pandemic, I did lose track of her. I don't know where she ended up. But throughout 2019, her engagement with the church, it followed a predictable pattern. She'd return to student ministry. She'd be in student ministry for a short time, and then she'd say, I'll never come back. I'm never coming back, because she was offended at some level due to her moral beliefs and the moral implications of the gospel and her moral ethical beliefs with what we were saying. Were she just didn't like those, and she preferred her own morals to the morals that were the implications of the gospel. And yet after she'd say, I'm never coming back because I can't stand what you all are teaching, then she'd be back a few weeks later. And I never asked why, but I think I know why. I think it was because the people of God at church loved her and cared for her in a way that nobody in her home was, nobody at school was, nobody else was, even though she still steadfastly refused to embrace the gospel and its moral implications. And as far as I know, at least at that time, she never was persuaded that Christianity was good for the world, but she had discovered that Christians could be good to her. And someday, somehow, somewhere, I pray that God will work through that knowledge to clear up that moral confusion as he draws her to himself. And in the meantime, what the church does and what the church is to do is to persist in defending the goodness and the truth of the Christian faith with all of its moral implications, and forming God's people to proclaim that truth, knowing that God is still at work through the gospel, even in a world where we're all apologists because of the fact that Christianity is no longer assumed to be good for the world.
Last night, I was teaching on the mission of the church, but ultimately I was teaching on the mission of God and kind of doing that through the lens of Acts. And it's just, it seems so clear. Luke frames, I mean, he begins the book this way and it shows up at key turning points in Acts, but essentially the mission of the church is to bear witness, right? To bear witness to God's kingdom, both the way that it's broken into creation now, but ultimately when it will come in his fullness. And when we bear witness to the kingdom, we are bearing witness to the King, Christ, who reigns and rules even now, but fully and totally and comprehensively when he comes back for us to renew all of creation, to restore it to its original design. And bearing witness, as far as I can tell, correct me if I'm wrong, Timothy, bearing witness doesn't take on this meaning of convincing other people, right? Making known, yes, but that doesn't mean convincing. And when you tell the story of this high school girl, I think we see it, right? She doesn't, as far as we know, she wasn't convinced. But I think that you and the youth ministry at Sojourn did bear witness to the King and his goodness in a way that compelled her. And it seems to me that the argument that Aristides is making is simply a fleshing out of what Jesus had commanded us to do.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. If you're interested in supporting the Apologetics Podcast, go to patreon.com/threechords and the truth. As always, that's chords with an H, the kind you play, not the kind you plug.
To listen to more episodes or to learn more about the two of us, take a look at our website at theapologeticspodcast.com.
Also, if you're interested in learning more about apologetics, ministry, and leadership in urban contexts, you might enjoy the Urban Ministry Podcast. Go to urban.sbts.edu to learn more about this podcast. My name is Timothy Paul Jones. My co-host is Garrick Bailey, and we are already looking forward to joining you next time on the next exciting episode of the Apologetics Podcast.